Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and worldwide at KMJ580.com on the internet. Just that website, click on the Listen Live link. And remember, if you ever missed the program, you can listen to it after the fact by going to KMJ Podcasts at KMJ580.com. Today, a chance to talk to a man who's been through a little bit in his life, recently celebrated his 65th wedding anniversary, but there was a time where he thought he might never see his wife again, the time that he spent in Stalag Luft I in Germany, which was liberated just about 63 years ago. In fact, we're pretty close to the time when all of that came about. It was in late April, early May of 1945 that POW camp was liberated. But long before he became a prisoner of war, Gordon Redfelt had a lot of other things on his mind. He's our guest today, lived in Visalia for quite a long time. He now lives in Northern California in Fortuna. Gordon, thanks for being with us today.
What was that?
I said thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, too. We love it up here.
I don't blame you. I know you miss a lot of your friends in Visalia, and a lot of the young people who've grown up in Visalia have heard your story. You've done a lot of speeches in different classrooms, and you've done a really magnificent job of preserving some of the history of what you and guys like you went through. Let's start at the beginning, though. How did you end up in the Army Air Corps?
I worked for Douglas Aircraft, and I was working on SPD dive bombers, and I decided that I was 20 years old, and I could see that I was going to be drafted in spite of my work in the aircraft industry. So I went down and volunteered to join the Army Air Corps in October 1942.
Now, did you want to be a pilot?
I thought I did.
Just about everyone who joins the Army Air Corps says he wants to become a pilot, I think.
Yes, that's right. So when I went to the classification center, they classified me qualified to be a pilot, a navigator, or a bombardier. And so they just decided, all of a sudden they were short of pilots, so they ordered us all into the pilot program. And I went in training at Ryan Field, Tucson, Arizona, and I just wasn't able to cut the mustard on being a pilot. Actually, there's other extenuating circumstances which I won't go into, but I was washed out of pilot training and then sent back to Santa Ana, where I became they said, "Would you want to be a bombardier or a navigator?" And I said, "Well, I've always loved math, and I would like to be a navigator." So I went off to gunnery school in Las Vegas and became a gunner. And then from there, I was transferred to navigation school in Texas, where I graduated in June of 1944.
And before that, somewhere along the line, while you were in Long Beach, you met a lovely young lady named Lucille.
Yes, that's right. It was interesting, and there was my brother and two other fellows and myself and Lucille and her twin sister, and we kind of roamed around together, and the first thing you know, Lucille and I kind of paired off, and that was the beginning.
In fact, and I mentioned that the two of you just celebrated your 65th wedding. Congratulations. That's a rare milestone these days, and you're to be commended for it. But it was a first. You were married in Caldwell, Idaho, and what was so groundbreaking about your nuptials there?
We were married by the chaplain from Boise Air Force Base, and I carried the Bible that he gave us at that time all through my time as a POW.
And you two were the first couple married there, correct?
Yes, we were the first couple married at the College of Idaho in World War II.
The first military wedding at that base.
Right, at the college.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have cross swords because we were aviation students. We had cross brooms.
I guess you had to deal with what you had available at the time.
Yeah, we had to sweep up right and left there as aviation students.
And not long after that, your newlywed bliss was interrupted by Uncle Sam, who said, guess what? You get to go to England with the 8th Air Force as a navigator on a B-17. What was it like when you crossed the Atlantic?
What was that?
What was it like when you crossed the Atlantic?
It was kind of different, you know, but I liked flying, so that was why we went right on over.
And as so many POWs will tell the story, they didn't get a lot of missions in. You don't hear too many stories of a guy who had 35, 40 missions and then got shot down and then ended up in a POW camp. It seems that more often than not, the guys telling those stories are ones that very early on in their time in the air were shot down and became POWs. And for you, it was your eighth for the eighth. Eighth mission.
My eighth mission. And the average for Army Air Corps bombers was 7 missions. We're supposed to fly 35, so the odds were pretty much against you of completing a tour.
Did you know that at the time you took off for your eighth?
Yes, we thought we were over the hump.
Now, before we get to the events of your B-17 being shot down, and I do want to hear all about that, as a navigator on a big plane like that, what are your duties? What are you called upon to do while you're in the air? And are you solely responsible for keeping that plane on target with the coordinates your mission has given you?
What our job was to do was to take the B-17 to what they called the IP, which was an initial point, where then it was turned over to the bombardier, who flew the airplane into the target area. He actually flew the airplane, and that's when we were the most vulnerable, because no one could deviate. You had to stay on that same course, no matter whether it was fighters or flak or what. So that was the most critical area. I was on a mission on the 5th of November, and it was to... This was a different, my sixth mission. And then we were approaching Merseburg, which was near Leipzig. And it was a 20-minute IP run into the target and a 20-minute out. We had 1,000 B-17s and B-24s bombing that day. And we lost 156 in about 40 minutes.
Holy cow.
And, about half of them became POWs, and the other half were killed.
Which is not exactly encouraging when you're taking off for your next mission.
Yes, it showed you that the losses were running 15% every mission.
So you had a feeling that at some point your number is going to get called, even if you felt you got over the hump with 7 missions in the bag. Tell us about how number 8 shaped up. Let's get a little bit of that story before we take a commercial break here.
About when?
About your eighth mission. What do you remember about how that began and how it ended?
Well, we were just going on the bomb run when we got a hit in our number one engine, and it blew a big hole in the wing and caught on fire. And the pilot, immediately the bombardier salvoed the bombs, and the pilot dove the airplane down towards the undercast to try to put the fire out. Well, we were at 26,000 feet. This was about 11:30 in the morning, and we were at 26,000 feet. Well, we got leveled off at about 15,000 feet under the clouds, and the fire had gone out as we went through the rain clouds. But about that time, we lost number 4 engine, so there we were with 2 engines, and so the pilot asked for a heading, and I gave him a heading for France, because I knew we couldn't go to Switzerland because of the Alps, and I knew we couldn't get to Sweden because we'd have to fly over Berlin. And so...
I imagine your blood was pumping a little bit at that moment, huh? When the pilot says, tell me where I can go, and you're trying to figure it out in your head?
Well, I knew where we were, so I just immediately gave him a heading, and so he said, well, what's our ETA for France? And this, I told him 2:30 in the afternoon, which was like, you know, 2 more hours of flying on 2 engines. And he said, are you sure? And I said, yes, we're doing 90 indicated, and we got a 45-knot headwind, which meant the cars on the ground are traveling faster than we were, I think.
Not exactly encouraging either.
No, and so we started throwing everything out. We threw out 13 50-caliber machine guns and threw out 5,000 rounds of 50-caliber ammo.
So some Germans on the ground got a few surprises.
Oh, yeah. We threw out all our flak suits. We threw out all our survival gear. We threw out everything except their parachutes. And so, and about that time, the tail gunner said, well, we've got four fighters coming in at 6 o'clock. And they turned out to be P-51s. And they, two of them on each side of us, and they stayed with us until we got to the Rhine River. And that was about 1:30. About 1:30.
Were you breathing a little bit easier when you had that escort?
Well, we knew what we had to cross, and it was heavy, heavy anti-aircraft fire. And it broke out clear over the Rhine River. And there was, we had the blackest cloud develop around us because, you know, all the guns could shoot at us because we're the only ones there. And pretty quick, we got three direct hits, and the pilot went, the plane went into a dive. And he finally got it leveled off at 3,500 feet. We couldn't get out of the airplane because of the centrifugal force. And so when he got it leveled off, we all started bailing out as fast as we could. And I got up first out of the nose, and I landed in a huge oak tree and fractured three vertebrae in my back when I went into the tree.
Oof.
And so when I got on the ground, I could not walk. And so I sat there for a while, and then pretty quick I was able to get up, and I started going up into the woods, and I followed this trail, and I came around the corner and walked directly into a German corporal and two privates. And they said told me immediately, "For you, the war is over."
I think that was in their manual. I've heard a few POWs say that they were told the exact same thing, and I imagine that it holds a little more weight when you've got a revolver pointing right at your face.
Yeah, I think they trained the soldiers to say that.
That was some of the little English that some of them knew. Of course, some of their spies could speak perfect English.
Oh, yes.
But for those gentlemen, I suppose that was one of the phrases that was important for them to know.
Yeah, I was fortunate. I was captured by the Wehrmacht. That's the German army. My engineer was captured by the SS, and they broke his leg. And my radio operator was captured by the SS, and they beat him about the head with a bayonet.
Ugh.
So it, you know, and if you were captured by civilians, you really had a real major problem there.
Yeah, they would try to get any kind of bounty they could for you.
Right, especially if you just bombed them. I can understand that.
It is easy to understand, indeed. Yeah. Gordon, we need to take a real quick commercial break here, but we'll come back and we'll talk about what happened to you after you hit the ground and were taken prisoner, and what the ensuing months were like for you there at Stalag.
Okay, I'll run and get a drink.
Good idea. Gordon Redfelt is our guest, a POW during World War II, and a navigator on a B-17. You won't believe the things that he endured in the POW camp and how long he continued to serve in our nation's military long after World War II. Much more to come as Hometown Heroes continues with World War II veteran Gordon Redfelt today on News Talk 580 KMJ. Is what Gordon Redfelt had in mind when he signed up with the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II. And on his eighth mission, as you heard him describe, his B-17 was shot down. He parachuted to the ground, fracturing himself in several places when he hit an oak tree, found the strength to start walking away, and ran smack dab into three German soldiers who quickly told him, "For you, the war is over." And Gordon, before we get to what happened to you on the ground, I understand that maybe you and your crew had a little bit of an inkling that might be the day that you got shot down because of the position that you occupied in the formation. Every position in that formation is a little different. Some are more vulnerable than others. And you were in part of the formation that was not so affectionately known as Purple Heart Corner. Is that right?
That's right. And also, our not only was our position in Purple Heart Corner, but our number aircraft, the number of our mission for us, not that we're flying, but our number as a crew was S-13.
Ah, the unlucky 13. Right.
Well, it's always been lucky for me since then.
Well, I guess it got you enough on one end. They had to repay you the rest of the time.
Yeah.
So you were describing for us how you were captured by German forces. You were thankful that you were captured by the Wehrmacht as opposed to the SS or civilians, because you were treated at least a little bit better. But it wasn't exactly a picnic getting packed into a 40 and 8, was it?
No. They put us in a kind of a warehouse for the first night. And then the next day, they had captured a bunch of American GIs. They had 150 GIs they had captured near Aachen, and they put us with them. And so then they said, okay, you guys are all going to walk to Bonn, which was 15 miles away. And it was, you know, in the winter of 44, and it was snow and ice everywhere. And we said, well, we can't, what are we going to do with, the engineer? He has a broken leg. They said, you carry him or you leave him. And so it was quite a few walking wounded among the GIs, and it took us all day to get to Bonn, 15 miles, with no food or anything.
That winter, of course, was the worst winter to date in Germany. All the Battle of the Bulge veterans will tell you all about that.
Yeah.
And here you're experiencing and carrying one of your comrades the whole way.
Right. They were not from the Battle of Bulge. They were prior to the battle, but we went down right where the battle took place.
Right, and it's that same winter that the guys in Bastogne and around there experienced.
And so they took us into this concentration camp in Bonn, and I knew it was a concentration camp because there was huge piles of shoes and clothes and that sort of thing, and people wandering around in black and white striped suits, and they really looked bad. And so we thought, gee, is this where we're going to end up? Well, they said, no, you're going to be here tonight. And they gave us a little bowl of watery soup made with carrot tops. And that was all we had all day. And so they said, in the next morning, they got us up and loaded us in the H, which is a boxcar. They put 75 of us in each car. And you couldn't sit down. You had to stand up.
Well, they were called 40 and 8s for a reason.
They were
40 men or 8 horses, right?
That's the way it was, but there were 75 of us in each car, so we had 2 cars. And so we were in there 2 days, no water, nothing, you know. And when I got in the car, I thought, well, I'll better get over by that little window. There's a little window. If anybody has seen a 40 and 8, it's about 2x3 up in one corner with barbed wire over it. And I got under that to be able to get some fresh air. And it was a good place, but it was a bad place, Paul, because all the body waste had to be passed overhead in these steel helmets and poured out that window. So it was not a good, it was a good spot and a bad spot.
So say no more. Point
taken.
Yeah,
the second day, we were in those marshalling yards, and the British had come in and bombed us really bad the night before, but they didn't hit our boxcar, thanks goodness. But the next morning, there was a guard there, and I asked him if he could speak English, and he said, yes, I can speak English. So I said, well, you know, we have a lot of wounded in here, and some of them can't sit down or anything, and they really need water desperately. And I said, is there any water around? He said, well, yeah, about 50 meters down the track, there's a faucet with water. And I said, well, how about opening the car and letting us go down there and get water? And he said, no way. He said, you guys should try to escape. And he said, I can't do that. So I said, well, come around the door. So he came around the door. He was about a middle-aged man. And he came around the door, and I said, open the door about 6-8 inches. So he did, and I talked to him for a while. And he knew the war was going to be over pretty quick. You know, we thought it was going to be over right away, but you know how it is.
Would have been nice.
Yeah, and it was going to be another 6 months. But so I said, well, now, if I give you my word of honor as an officer that I won't try to escape, and my bombardier, who was a flight officer, I said, he won't try to escape, and the two of us will get out, and we can take the steel helmets and go carry the water. And he thought of it a bit, and they had a lot of respect for their officers, just like our people had, hopefully, respect for our officers, you know. And so he said, okay, you two can get out. But he says, I want to warn you, those two fellows down at the end of the car there, their families were killed last night in that bombing raid. And he says, I can't guarantee that you'll get down there and get back. Well, I always look back and I say to myself, I can't believe I got out of there and went and did that. But I was a ranking officer in the car. There was only one, there was another a second lieutenant, a field grade, a field promotion. And so I got out in the bombardier and we did that. And I always look back on that and say, well, maybe that's where we always had that saying that ex-POWs try to help those that cannot help themselves.
And that's what you were doing in that situation.
Right.
With little regard for your own safety. And looking back, it seems like it was a little crazier than it probably seemed to you at the time, it sounds like.
I guess so. Well, somebody had to do it, you know, Paul.
Well, I think there are a lot of guys that were very thankful that you were that one who did make that decision and took that initiative. And your will and your perseverance would be tested quite a bit more over the ensuing months, because eventually those box cars continued to transport you, and you ended up at Barth on the Baltic at Stalag Luft 1.
Yes, I ended up at the interrogation center and spent 2 weeks in solitary there waiting to move on. And from
did
there
you
on
find
on,
that they knew everything about you that you didn't know about yourself?
They had all the information. They knew the mess officer's name at our bomb group, and I didn't even know his name.
And that's a little unnerving, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's very important to know the mess officer's name. No, what they wanted you to do was verify something, and then whoever that source of that information was, then they could assume that everything he sent was good information.
Right.
So that was their main thrust. I didn't know anything. I was a second lieutenant, and I didn't even know where the next mission was going to be, you know.
And a good thing you didn't, because I'm sure they would have tried to get it out of you somehow.
Yeah, they would have. So anyway, we moved then on, got another train ride of 5 days to Stalag Luft 1. And there, when I got into Stalag Luft 1, we got into this brand new barracks, and we had this one room, and there was 24 of us in the room, and we had one first lieutenant. All the rest of us were second lieutenants and flight officers, giving you an idea of how quickly people got shot down, you know. And so they looked around the room, and my friend Fred Toll was married, and I was married, and so we decided, well, we had to cook our own meals and everything in the room, and we didn't have hardly anything to do it with. And so they said, looked at me and they said, well, how about you being cooked for 12 guys in the morning, and how about you, Fred, doing it in the afternoon? And I said, well, you know, I started to protest, and they said, look, you two guys are both old married men. We're 22, you know, old married men, and you both know how to cook. So it wasn't difficult, Paul. I had a 10-quart galvanized bucket, and everything went in the bucket, usually.
And by everything, you mean everything.
I mean everything. well, right, you know, it wasn't very long after we were there that all we had was rutabagas, frozen potatoes, and roadkill. And I never actually have identified much roadkill to people that want to know what roadkill is.
Well, and I don't know. It depends on how tough the stomachs of our listeners are this afternoon. Tell you what, why don't we take another commercial here, and we'll contemplate that. When we come back, we'll talk more about your culinary expertise in the barracks at Stalag Luft 1 and the other things that you had to endure there.
Okay.
We'll take a short break, come back with more Hometown Heroes as we visit with ex-prisoner of war Gordon Redfeld today here on News Talk 580 KMJ. Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we hear stories about prisoners of war during World War II, particularly at Stalag Luft 1, where Gordon Redfelt spent six memorable months of his life. Gordon lived in Visalia for a long time, now lives in Fortuna. Maybe there's a hero in your hometown, a veteran that you would like us to know about and maybe feature on this program sometime. If so, give me an email, paul@kmj580.com, and I'll be sure to respond and see if we can work something out. Let's continue now with Gordon Redfelt, who's been kind enough to join us today. And Gordon, you were telling us how you were appointed one of the two cooks in your room full of 24 prisoners of war. They said because you were married, and you'd been married for, what, a year and a half?
About a year and a half, yes.
And, of course, you got married and then had to go overseas. So you hadn't had that much experience in the kitchen, but you learned to pretty quick. And when you say you put everything in the pot, I know that you guys ate things that you never would have imagined eating outside of maybe some boyhood curiosity.
Yes. We didn't have a rodent problem. The German commander had about three or four cats there at one time, and before the war was over, his cats all mysteriously disappeared.
You know, that's funny you mentioned that. I have another friend who was at Stalag Luft 1, and this is what's one thing that's been really amazing as I got to know some of the veterans in this area, and there's probably more of them out there. You're one of half a dozen veterans that I've met that were all in Stalag Luft 1 at the same time, and all at the time were within an hour radius of Fresno, which it's a pretty small world when you think about that. And one of them, a gentleman named Pete Komlinich, who lives up in Merced, was heartbroken because he had a pet Kriege cat, and it ended up being consumed at some point by some other POWs in the camp. I'm not saying that you're responsible for that, that was just the harsh reality of the situation you were in.
And it's like we said, you know, for our Christmas dinner, we did have a Red Cross Christmas parcel. But people always ask me, and I tell them, well, yeah, we had dehydrated turkey, you know. And they said, dehydrated turkeys, how could you have that? I said, well, some people call them English sparrows, but, you know. But
they're a little smaller than a turkey because they've been shrunk. Huh?
I did get a raven one time during a snowstorm out in the yard.
And you can laugh about it now, but did it seem like desperation at the time? What kept your spirits up? How did you keep going through that? Because you didn't know when the war was going to be over, who was going to win the war, whether the Russians would get there before the Americans could liberate you. I mean, there was a lot to be concerned about here.
Yeah. Well, we had a radio in our compound, which was secreted in one of the walls. It was built by the British. And every night at midnight, they would listen in and get the news from BBC. And that's the only time it was ever turned on. And so what happened was we had three chaplains in our camp, and they would prepare their paperwork for Sundays. And in the process, we had one fellow who would type up the news on what we called a flimsy. It was just like an onion skin paper. And copies, there was four compounds. So what happened was they would slip it into a can and toss it over the fence into the other compound, so that each compound would have a copy. Then at night in the dark with a candle, we would read the news, so we knew pretty much. We were a couple, 3 days behind, but our news was pretty well up to date. So I was in charge of the, because I was a navigator, I was put in charge of keeping the map of the movements of the Allies from both directions. When we got there, we were about, almost 300 miles from the Russians and also 300 miles from the Allies. So we were a long ways, you know, and so the Germans would put up a board which showed the German news. Now, this news would never say that a city had fallen. They would say they were fighting beyond, say, Frankfurt, or fighting beyond Cologne, or, you know. And so what I did is I just kept plotting these salients on my map, because I got together with several navigators, and we were able to put together a reasonably good map, so that we kept that up to date. And so we knew when they were getting fairly close from both sides, but they were coming about the same speed both ways.
Other than the near starvation and the having to eat things that you never would have imagined eating, how were you treated by the Germans at the camp?
I would say more or less ignored more than anything. We had to fall out in the morning for our roll call, and you know, it's 40 below up there on the Baltic, and it was bad. And of course, after roll call, we'd stand out there probably an hour just getting counted, because they had to count everybody in the barracks that was sick. And of course, we tried to create a little bit of turmoil for them too by stepping back and forth in the lines when they weren't looking, and then the German commander would really get teed off when they couldn't get the correct count. And they did have a temper, some of them. Then after that, we would go in for our massive breakfast of a piece of German bread, you know, burnt brown on top of the stove, so we'd eat it.
And half sawdust, right? Or 90% sawdust?
Yes. Almost 90% sawdust. Tree flour, it was called.
Tree flour, that's right. Yes. Yeah. Not sawdust, it's tree flour.
No, it wasn't sawdust. See, tree flour.
You guys were the original spin doctors, or they were there by calling that tree flour. You had to come up with all kinds of euphemisms to get yourself through those experiences.
Oh, I don't know. Somebody came up with it, but we got a hold of the formula.
And how did you ever have to cut those loaves?
I ruined my hearing in Vietnam, Paul, and I have a little bit of a problem, in case people understand that sometimes I have to, some words don't come together too good for me. What was that, Paul?
Well, and I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it's one thing that I wanted to get to at some point, that not only did you serve in World War II, that you endured all those months as a prisoner of war, but after that, you served not only in the Korean conflict, but in Vietnam as well as a navigator. How many hours did you end up logging in the air for?
I have about almost 5,000 hours.
Holy moly.
On 26 different types of aircraft.
26 different aircraft. Well, I think I speak for not just myself, but all those in our audience when I say thank you from all of us for your service to our country over all those years. And I'll probably say that again before we're done here. What I was asking you was about those brick loaves of bread with all the tree flour in them. Were you ever responsible for attempting to slice those and to slice them evenly for all the guys in the room? Because to me, that was maybe one of the toughest tasks someone could have in a POW.
Well, what we had to do, Paul, we had to cut them about as thin as a sheet of paper, for one thing, if you could cut them that thin, because they contained rocks, pieces of glass, and pieces of wood. So after we sliced it, we had to pick all that stuff out, because, you know, glass is not really digestible, and maybe the wood might have been, but the glass was not, and the rocks. And so we would get... I think we got a loaf a month, something like that. I might mention also that all during my stay, from the time I was shot down till I got back to France, I had a total of 3 5-minute showers. And, you know, we didn't wash our clothes very often because it wasn't really necessary.
Well, I imagine not. And I know that Lucille was thankful that you actually got to get a shower or two in before you got home, though.
Yes, I managed. I try to get one a day now just to make up for it, Paul.
And you probably still haven't caught up after all these years.
And even sometimes I try to get two in one day. I'm almost caught up, I think.
I know that you still have a lot of mementos from your time there. You have sketches that you made, and you had to find so many different things to pass the time when you were a prisoner of war. And one thing that you and a lot of POWs did was keep a diary. You still have that diary?
Yes, I do.
And I know there are some things in there. How often do you go back and read that? Do you keep along with the date?
Oh, usually, Paul, when I get a little cocky around Lucille, she tells me, get over there and get your diary and read your diary again.
She keeps you honest. And the other thing that you had that whole time as a POW was, as you mentioned earlier, the Bible you were given in Caldwell, Idaho, when the two of you were married in April of 1943. How often was that opened up during your POW stay?
I didn't understand, Paul.
You had the Bible that was given to you when you were married?
Yes, I still have it.
Is that something that was meaningful to you during your time as a POW?
Meaningful. believe me, we used it. It's pretty well worn. I had a picture of Lucille with me and my wedding ring, and I was able to bring all three of them home.
Which is no small feat.
Yes, that's right.
I'll tell you what, Gordon, I want to hear more about that diary. Maybe you could even read an entry from your diary on this date 63 years ago to us. So while you track that down, we'll take our last commercial break here, and we'll come back and go down the home stretch. Ex-prisoner of war Gordon Redfelt is our guest today, and we'll finish up with him when we come back. Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
In a
on the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. An hour seems like it's never enough to get all the great stories in from these World War II veterans, and it's been such a privilege to share this time today with Gordon Redfelt, who served not just in World War II, where he became a prisoner of war at Stalag Luft I, but again in Korea and Vietnam, flying in 26 different aircraft over his long military career as a navigator. And we left off talking about the fact that Gordon kept a diary during his stay as a prisoner of war at Stalag Luft I in Barth, Germany. And he still has that diary to this day. And he's agreed to look back at about this time, late April of 1945, and give us a little excerpt of what was on his mind at the time. What do you have there, Gordon?
I have, well, I'll start March 1st, and I enter Happy Day. We go to get a shower and have our clothes deloused. We have been waiting 2 weeks since we've been infested with lice, crabs, scabies, and who knows what else. So far, I've been able to keep clear of these varmints. Then March 5th, Dick White and I are very sick with dysentery. We've been at the latrine most of the day. Tonight, we have been to the honey bucket room several times. While we were there, I opened the window shutters about 2 feet to let some fresh air in, as it was quite bad in that small room. All of a sudden, a German Shepherd guard dog raced up and attempted to get inside. I was barely able to get the window closed before he could get in. This really upset me. I returned to our room and got my rolling pin, which I had made from a limb of a tree. Dick slid the shutter back just enough for him to get his head in, paws in, and I hit him as hard as I could, and he fell back on the ground making a lot of noise. We were hoping he'd fall inside because the pot was waiting for him. All the searchlights came on, and the guards came running. We retreated to our room, replacing the rolling pin on the wall. They came and searched our barracks for a weapon. We ended up with a very exciting day, even if we were sick.
Well, if the SPCA is listening, I hope that they can forgive you for the desperation of wartime. I have another friend who was in that same camp, Stalag Luft I, who told me that sometimes they'd take the pepper from the Red Cross parcels and spread that out under the barracks where those dogs would run, and then the dogs would have sneezing fits. So anything they could do to get in the their captor's craw, as it were, I guess you guys were willing to make those efforts.
Right.
And as the spring went on in 1945, it started to become clearer to you that the war was coming to a close. And you captured some of that in your diary, too, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I have my last entry in the diary. I stopped. Just, if you'll just a second, I'll get right to it here.
How are those pages holding up?
Huh?
How are those pages holding up?
Oh, wonderful. May 1st, we are free. We have Americans in all the guard towers. The German guards slipped away sometime last night. No Russians yet. And that was my last entry.
Wow. And there was a lot of fear that the Russians would be the ones to end up in control of those prisoners. Nearly 9,000 prisoners who were there at Stalag Luft I on the time, mostly American, but some British as well. And it was a stroke of good fortune that you were able to be evacuated by Americans, taken to Camp Lucky Strike, and then eventually make it back home to the States. What was it like for you? Describe for us the moment when you got to see your bride again. And now you and Lucille have been married for 65 years. I'm sure there are some days in Stalag Luft I where you didn't know if you'd ever see her again. When you finally did get to see her again, what was that like for you?
It's hard to say, Paul. It was wonderful. My daughter was, well, see, I didn't get home until July. But my daughter was almost a year old. And they came and picked me up at the bus station at Fresno, because that's the way we were handled. When I got back to Camp Beale, they said, well, we got to give you physicals and all that. How do you feel? Well, everybody felt wonderful because we wanted to go home, you know. And so they said, okay, here's a ticket to Fresno. You go out and get on the Greyhound bus and go home. And that's what I did. And she met me at the bus station, and it was just absolutely wonderful.
I'm sure that memory is still crisp and clear in your mind. And I guess because of it, Fresno will always have a special place in your heart.
What was that?
I said, I guess Fresno will always have a special place in your heart because of that moment right there.
Yes, they do. It's a wonderful town, really, Fresno is.
Now, so you went through all that in World War II, shot down, break your legs as you're falling to the ground, or you've had fractured bones because of hitting an oak tree. You're captured by the Germans. You're held in a prisoner of war camp. You endure all these hair-raising experiences. And then you wanted more of the military? Why did you decide to go back in for Korea and even Vietnam? Why was that important for you to do?
Well, you know, when I was a prisoner, they came and got us. And I, you know, I've always felt that I voted to my country, and I'll be participating in something up here. If you want me to tell you about it real quickly.
Feel free.
It's a 9th Aviation Conference in Fortuna, California, September 27th, and I'll be one of the guest speakers. This is being presented to 12 to 19-year-old students with individual educational interests to maximize the value of aviation to the community. And I'll be participating in it. It's an all-day conference, and this will be their 9th conference here, so I'm looking forward to it.
And you've been participating in things with young people for quite some time to educate them, to inspire them, to let them know the rich history that lies behind their freedom and the price that was paid for their freedom. Why is that something that's important to you?
I don't know, Paul. I like to do it, and I think that they're not teaching exactly the history that I would like to see taught in a school, so, you know, I did teach at SciCon at one time for a short while up above Fresno.
When you look back at all your time in the military, all those hours in the air, all those days on the ground at Stalag Luft 1 and everything that you endured for Uncle Sam, is there one thing that maybe means the most to you, that you're most proud of or most satisfied with that you were able to do?
Well, all I can tell you, Paul, is, you know, freedom is not free. We just have to keep plugging away, because that's what we're going to have, and that's why I'm looking towards this freedom for everyone.
Well, I think I join with everyone listening in saying a hearty amen to that. And thank you so much for spending some time with us today. Thank you even more for your long and dedicated service to our country. And I think I speak for a lot of people who know you that say I'm glad that you survived getting shot down and you survived 6 months in a POW camp, because a lot of people's lives would be a little bit different if you hadn't. Have you ever thought about that over the years?
Yes, I have thought about that. And I'm thankful for everything that, you know, that's taken place for me, and I'm quite happy, and I will continue to work, you know, towards education and helping the students really understand what World War II, or as far as that goes, the Korean War and Vietnam was all about.
Well, we thank you from the bottom of our hearts for that. And Gordon, thanks again for taking some time with us today. We're out of time on the program today, but you are a hometown hero. Visalia is not your hometown anymore. Now you're Fortuna's hometown hero, and I hope they're as proud of you there as we are here. That's the program for today. Join us again next week right here on News Talk 580 KMJ.